Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, and joining me once again is my co-host Pete.
I'm Pete.
And we are joining you once again today to talk about production episode 7 of The Muppet Show, guest starring Florence Henderson, which aired in New York City 45 years ago today on November 16th, 1976. Pete, you have been consistently rating the guest stars at the end of the episode, but we haven't been keeping a rating of the individual episodes as a whole as to how they do. But I'm going to go out on a limb and say this is the best episode of the show so far. It feels exactly like what I think ideal Muppet shows in my head feel like. And the fact that they waited this long to put production episode 7 out and sort of faffed around with later and earlier episodes, I'm a little astonished. I think they should have led with this earlier because it's that good.
I agree. And also shocking is we've seen episodes that were produced after this one. Mm-hmm. We've seen later production episodes
that aren't as good.
Not only aren't as good, this episode is visually interesting.
Mm.
There's lots of different camera angles. They're doing interesting things. And there are episodes we've seen later that are just still cameras, no motion, no interesting angles at all.
Without a change in the director.
Yeah. I wrote down who directed it, and as soon as I did, I was like, oh yeah, he's directed almost all of these, I'm sure, because I recognize that name.
So there was experimentation going on in this episode, and then wasn't necessarily immediately followed on afterwards, which could lead us directly into the realm of speculation. Maybe this was a hard episode. Maybe they used up too many resources, and they were like, well, we can't do that again. Perhaps it was demanded by the guest star, and other guest stars weren't as needy. But there were things going on in this that were different, and it heartens. I hope that as we continue to do these episodes and review these shows, more and more episodes will actually feel like this one, as opposed to my memory being that this is what all episodes feel like. If this ends up being an outlier, that will be a disappointing revelation.
Yep. Yeah, of the memory of the Muppets not being as good as your memory is.
Consistently.
Yeah.
That there are bright spots that do reach this level, but that most of them are beneath this, is a real possibility. But I hope that as the show continues and as the seasons continue, more and more of them hit this exact level or better of creativity, of innovation, and experimentation.
I agree. It will be a rough 5 years if this is one of the high points.
The running order of the show is that we are going to talk about the sketches as they appeared in the episode. Once we've gone through all of them that don't feature the special guest star, we'll do the trivia, then we will talk about all of the sketches that did involve the special guest star, and then we will wrap up the episode by talking about our additive series of statistics and any special moments that we think are deserving of praise before we sally off into that good night. So let us start, as we always do, by saying how the show, as always, opens.
So yes, the show opens, as always, with the opening credits. Fozzie has his opening joke since we discussed this last week,
mm-hmm.
7 seconds.
Prices are so high, yesterday I bought a pound of hamburger and had to have a cosigner.
And again, this feels like a joke that was written to feel like a professional joke.
Mm-hmm. Which, coming up later, he talks about buying a new act,
yes,
so
he
maybe
does.
He bought this joke too with it. The joke is also somewhat appropriate currently, because prices are going up right now. Then Gonzo goes to hit the sign, but the sign starts raising as he's swinging it, but he just barely hits it, and it still makes the noise.
And everyone applauds, and Gonzo looks very pleased with himself.
Then we have Kermit introducing the show. He talks about Florence. I wrote Flo exclusively, so I'm probably going to... And also in college, I had a teacher named Flo, so I will probably call her Flo exclusively throughout the show. I apologize, Mrs. Henderson.
For that over-familiarity.
Indeed, indeed. Kermit then introduces the Bouncing Borsellino Brothers, a acrobatic pig act based out of Boston.
Boston, famous for its pigs.
I think they did it just so they could...
Say Boston.
Yeah, but also they didn't do it with quick enough succession to use that alliteration as an additional joke. Because they say from Boston, and then pause, and then say the Bouncing Borsellino Brothers. They should have said the Boston Borsellino... Bouncing... Okay, I figured out why they didn't do it.
At which point, yes, we don't know prior to this point that they are pigs, but there is... jouncy acrobat music, and a whole slew of pigs run on stage, bouncing up and down and generally bouncing into each other and falloping about for then perhaps the longest, most drawn out, I was about to say human pyramid, porcine pyramid by the Bouncing Borsellino Brothers.
Out of Boston.
The lead pig talking to the audience...
Tiny
is his name, is a giant honker of a pig, and because he's introducing the act to the audience, is the last to climb onto the pyramid. It's therefore, while structurally not an inverse pyramid, it is by weight, and he collapses the entire six pigs through the floor of the stage.
And then we get a shot of the stage with them having broken through it, and they come up, some of them have...
pieces of wood in their mouths.
Yeah, and one of them has another one of the pigs in his mouth. One of the first bites of the episode.
Ooh.
Extra stat. Not a recurring stat, but there were a lot of bites in this episode, so I tallied them.
We'll see if that remains a one-off or if it needs to be added to the pile of things that we track. Yeah, but the shot of the cut to the above camera looking down at the stage with the big hole in it is not anything we've seen before, naturally, because we don't tend to see the Muppets' feet.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing the floor of the stage is been, prior to this point, basically taboo for elemental reasons.
I think I've seen it before.
Because of the... Danceros sketch.
Thank you. I couldn't have even pulled that, and I saw it. So, yes. But other than that, yeah, I don't think we've seen it. We may see it sometimes when there's the shot when Fozzie is doing his act.
When you can see it stretch away from Fozzie standing in the foreground up to waist height.
Yeah.
But in general, it is, up to our experience in this point, a unique camera shot in order to emphasize the punchline that they fell through the floor.
Yeah. Yeah, instead of, because otherwise you would have just assumed they collapsed and fell to the stage.
Right. But. Even with the additional Foley sound effect of perhaps wood splintering and breaking.
And then them coming up, they could have come back up with wood in their mouths.
That would have been a simpler way to do it with the kind of ways in which they've locked off the camera before. So to do that extra bit is a piece of technical, I don't want to say gilding the lily because that makes it sound excessive, a flavoring to make sure that it's that much funnier.
Mm-hmm. And it works.
We cut to Statler and Waldorf up in the box.
And they seem to enjoy that and then say, hey, that act brought down the house, or at least the stage. Ha ha.
It's a good combination of them being able to poke fun at them and say that it was enjoyable at the same time.
Yeah.
They seem to be mostly positive this episode.
They do. Unlike last episode.
Backstage, then, we finally get the... pigs wandering in, debris strewn, a little banged up, past Kermit in the wings. And
it's revealed that Tiny weighs 975 pounds.
And Kermit calls to George to come clean up after that.
But he doesn't want to. He's sick and tired of cleaning up after lousy pigs.
And when Kermit says that...
Well, George, you can always quit.
What? And get out of show business?
The trivia track on the DVDs... quite blithely says, this is a very old joke. Or, this is a very old showbiz story. One or the other. What interested me is that this joke, almost verbatim, is reproduced in the memoir of Bernie Brillstein, who founded Brillstein Company, which went on to become Brillstein and Gray, the management company for stars and backstage below the line artists out in California. Brillstein was the first person to sign Jim Henson as an agent and manager. And he was largely one of the people that helped get the Muppet Show started. In fact, his failure to launch the Muppet Show was what caused him to commission Hee-Haw.
Mm.
Because he was like, how come I can't get a sketch show with laugh-in style jokes and puppets off the ground? Why does nobody want to do this? And so he came up with a version of it that would appeal to CBS's programming, which at the time, with Petticoat Junction and a number of other shows, was very rural-based. And so he got it out of what Henson was pitching. And if you remember the Muppet Valentine Show pilot, which had a screenwriter as the central focus character, always doing Hollywood scripts in the middle. I mean, that's a very urban show business focused thing. Hee-Haw was not.
Mm.
And it got bought. It was commissioned almost instantly. Brillstein tells this story. I found it to be an interesting coincidence.
Mm, yeah. Is Jim paying homage to Brillstein?
Is this a story that Brillstein and he would have traded and laughed about when they hung out together in the many years before the Muppet Show got started?
Yeah. And this is Jim's little nod to him.
Right.
So I have a question.
Hit me.
Funny you phrase it like that. At the end of this sketch, mm-hmm. when Kermit tells George to go do it anyway, mm-hmm. George turns around and whacks Kermit in the face with his mop.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a hit?
So, I'm going to get real highfalutin on this for a second,
mm-hmm.
like a big dummy. When we are in an automobile accident, we don't say, that person's car hit my car. We say, he hit me.
Uh-huh.
I think when you're using an object that is an extension of the senses in the body, like a bat, like a car, where we have to push ourselves out in order to move within it, when Kermit says to George to move the body, and he whacks him with a mop.
George, will you move the body?
All right, I'll move the body. I move the body.
That is an extension of George's body in that instance.
One additional hit. I kept it in a separate category.
Just in case.
Yep. So that's the first hit of the episode.
That is the first hit of the episode. Once George has whacked him and gone off to clean up the stage, we cut to the Blackout Street Gang.
Talking houses.
Where one of the... only two of the houses ever talk.
I also noticed that this episode, too, that the third and fourth house never say anything.
They're just there to have lights on in their eyes and make it look like more of a street.
Yeah. I don't think they're even puppeteered other than the
eyes.
Going down at the end.
I think their eyes swivel to look at the houses when they start talking.
Yeah.
But
there's no other...
There doesn't seem to be the mouth armature of the doors.
Or I think the awnings of the roof...
Like, tilt a little.
Yeah, like as if they were eyebrows.
Mm-hmm. Well, this joke is less about personification of the houses in their roles. This is just a dumb pun.
Mm-hmm.
This is classic McDonald's Happy Meal flap level jokes. This could be at a cracker in a...
Christmas crackers.
Christmas crackers. This could be a Christmas cracker joke. That level of terrible. This could be a Bazooka Joe comic.
Yeah, this joke is too bad to go on a popsicle stick.
My brother has ghosts in his attic.
Sounds scary.
Yeah, he's on the 10 most haunted list.
Blackout.
And if only the blackout had happened a few precious seconds earlier, we would have been spared that punchline. Then we get the first introduction by Kermit in front of the curtain of Florence Henderson, who does the first musical number. I think this might... we just had the show with the least amount of music in the previous episode. I'm willing to bet this one's going to jump to even less music.
Well, just you wait.
Once
we have those numbers.
I'm shocked.
Mm-hmm.
But for the moment, we will press on to the next backstage sketch.
So in reading the Muppetpedia, whatever it's called, Muppet Fandom, you may have never seen this backstage bit before.
Okay.
Because the note is that on Nickelodeon, this second backstage sequence was cut.
Well, that is entirely possible, because there is a specific performance moment in this that surprised the heck out of me.
I have a feeling I know what you're talking about, and I have a feeling it's going to be in one or both of our top moments.
But this is a clear escalation of the Kermit Piggy bits. Therefore, it makes a little sense to have had this happen after two episodes of Kermit saying to Piggy, "I don't have time for relationships in my life." He mounts no such defense here, but she is aggressive. And I believe uses the line, is it in this sketch, where she says,
"Forgive me for being so forward, but I'm a liberated pig."
It is. It is. After she kisses him, yes. And then Kermit attributes her attraction to him to his animal musk.
I think he's doing it in a way that he's fishing for an excuse, because I don't think
he's frogging for an excuse.
Womp womp. I don't think he believes that. I think he's just as surprised as anybody else that she would be that aggressively passionate towards him.
Mm-hmm. Then we go to the dance.
Six jokes in At the Dance this week.
Yeah, this took up most of this page of notes for me.
We begin with George and Mildred.
Pogo George watch. Different Pogo George. He's pogoing in an entirely new way that we've never seen before.
It's funny and violent.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Pogo George.
So,
yeah.
For those of you who don't know who Mildred is, Mildred has a large beaked face, an extremely long, pointy face, which has been great at delivering looks to camera, because the difference in her in profile and her looking down the barrel of the camera are very effective. And George is a short little round man. As he pogos, he is bouncing up into the underside of her giant
jaw, beak thing.
And this is done at the beginning of this joke and then comes back for an interstitial in between the other jokes.
Mm-hmm. It's fantastic.
Their joke is a little bizarre. George says that the trouble with kids these days is that they don't know what they want. And when he was a kid, he never wanted that.
Yeah.
That's like a Zen Cohen.
Yeah. It's a Homer, for sure.
I mean, his delivery of it is great, mm-hmm. and Mildred's response to it is great. Basically, Mildred's winning this sketch by not necessarily doing much, but by patiently and distressedly reacting to whatever the hell is going on.
And also not reacting to getting constantly headbutted in the jaw. Then two pigs come dancing by and cut in front of them, so they're blocking Mildred and George from the camera, and then dance away, and they refer to those pigs as a couple of floor hogs.
Mm-hmm. And they weren't even eating the floor like the previous pigs.
Yeah.
We have then two Muppets come on that we haven't seen since the pilot episode.
Mm-hmm.
Two trash monsters. In that sketch, they spoke only gibberish, much to Pete's dismay, where he considered the fake alien language to not be a particularly funny thing.
I didn't like it.
But here they're saying,
"I don't know, maybe it's the wine talking. In fact, I'm sure it is, but you're beautiful."
Yep, that's it.
It's just, they had these puppets lying around that were clearly designed to be ugly. They went for the ugliest of the ugly Muppets.
Yep. Then Rolf.
You don't even find the facial expression of the beautiful Muppet that looked to camera being so pleased at being called beautiful.
I guess I just don't like the trash monsters.
Pete, you need to embrace trash.
I mean,
be a trash person.
In the rest of my life, I have. I guess I just don't have room for this piece of trash in my life.
Then we have Rolf and the woman he regularly dances with.
And he accuses is a bit strong, but he accuses her of not liking dancing with a dog. She asks why, and he says, "Because you're wearing a flea collar." Then we got some of my favorite creatures.
"I think we ought to move out of the ghetto and find ourselves a nice little dump in the suburbs."
"Oh, honey, I love you like the plague."
Now, the trivia track says the return of the rats when they dance on screen. This is my first memory of seeing the rats. When have we previously seen them?
I can't say for certain, but they've definitely been dancing in the past.
Okay.
This might be their first joke, but they've definitely been in the background of other dances.
They're embracing garbage, Pete.
Hey, again, I'm with them. I just don't like those two trash monsters.
And then the final joke of At the Dance is that the loud lady and her suave Italian boyfriend take a moment to announce their engagement. This isn't a joke.
The joke in this is that Piggy hits the chandelier and it shakes and makes noise, and I like that. But you're right. Yeah, it's just she has an excuse to be loud.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
It is character performance, and considering that this is the third time I can remember the loud lady being on screen, while I think she, as a performance, is hilarious, I'm not sure I'm invested enough in her as a character to think that her moment of joy being loud and obnoxious is a thing that I can find as funny. One of the weird things about character-based humor is it subverts the subversion of humor. Unlike doing something that is against expectations, you do something that's expected and everybody thinks it's funny.
Now, what if I were to tell you that the last time we saw these two Muppets was in the Jim Neighbors episode, which was production 106. So if these were aired in production order, we would have seen them last week, and then this week they would have gotten engaged.
Was that the Earmuffs episode?
According to my notes, yes it is.
Okay. So they went from him saying, your voice is music to my ears, to them getting engaged in the course of a production episode.
Yeah.
Well, not bad.
Yeah.
He said the right thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't particularly funny then, but it worked.
Yeah, and worked out for them. And then Piggy hits the chandelier. So congratulations to the happy couple.
After At the Dance is the talk spot between Kermit and Florence with the surprise arrival of Miss Piggy. Then after that, we have the ad break, and we come back to Rolf singing Coddleston Pie by A.A. Milne in the UK spot.
Yep.
Ask me a riddle, and I reply, Coddleston, Coddleston, Coddleston Pie.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Pete.
What did you think I thought of this sketch?
Oh, interesting point. It is a Rolf solo sketch, which you have previously said is your least favorite version of Rolf. And in general, I think you may think that Rolf is in the bottom tier of Jim Henson performances. So the fact that you've asked the question leads me to believe you must like this sketch.
A subversion, as we just talked about, being humorous. I liked it a lot.
I love this sketch. It should be pointed out that while this sketch is a UK spot, and therefore US audiences wouldn't have seen it, it appears on the Muppet Show record that came out after or during the second season. So this has been part of my soundtrack for a very long time because I can vividly remember listening to this. I love Rolf's chatty, to-the-camera, I can't not talk about this song as I'm playing it stuff. It's the introduction and the key change that are...
Which you have brought up before of how this is a Jim Henson bit,
mm-hmm.
that this is probably calling back to that to make the crew laugh or to, as an Easter egg.
Now this is where the song changes key, what we call a modulation. That's G sharp minor.
Which is perhaps the most useless piece of trivia. What do I do with that? It still makes me laugh.
Yep. Also, in this part is they do another interesting camera thing when there's a short piano solo and you get a close-up of Ralph's paw on the keys playing those keys.
Yeah.
Which we've never seen before, and it's interesting.
It's very rare in a UK spot especially, which I have theorized is done with the least possible production effort in order to keep it cheap, considering it's going to be cut, to then have that insert shot of the piano playing. It helps emphasize how much and how good the performance of the handwork is, but it's also interesting that they decided they needed it.
Maybe it was very easy to do, so it was not a lot of extra setup for the crew to do.
This is from perhaps my favorite Winnie the Pooh story, which is the Eeyore's birthday story. And that one has been quietly emotional for me for quite a long time. In the middle of that story, when Pooh is confused by Eeyore's response, his passive-aggressive weirdness and free association while he's talking about other people being happy, who, in the middle of that conversation, sings this song in order to stop himself, as Rolf puts it, from his brain feeling fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
That's, in and of itself, a very weird piece of behavior.
Yep.
If you were talking to someone and they were doing something very strange and you decided to try and deal with that strangeness by singing a song, I think you would have outstranged the stranger. But it's a good piece of nonsense poem.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a great deal. I've heard that song before, probably on that Muppets album.
Mm-hmm. Didn't remember it.
As it was playing, I recognized it, but I didn't, you know, if you said...
Sing it.
No, absolutely not. Couldn't do it.
A small YouTube search produced a 1951 version of this song by composer Alex Wilder, who took the lyrics and composed a melody to it. Not this same melody.
Hmm.
I mean, there's only so much you can do with the same words and same number of syllables, but it's a fun thing to search out in terms of it's just similar enough and just off enough. The notes go in slightly different directions when you expect them to. It's a bit of a surreal experience.
That's fun. Then we go to the panel, mm-hmm. so we'll come back to that because that mm-hmm. features our pal Flo.
Very disrespectful. Look, I say that only because having just read her biography, I was surprised that nobody, like only one person calls her Flo in the whole book. Everybody else refers to her as Florence. We live in a world where nicknames are a form of feeling like you're close to a person. And the fact that she seems to have gone through her personal life being the more at arm's length Florence, which feels very distant and formal, is kind of interesting to me. Apparently, that's who she wanted to be known as.
Well, again, I apologize, Miss Henderson, but the panel features our pal Flo, so we will come back to that.
The end of the panel show is a Statler and Waldorf moment.
Where Waldorf has been napping and says, "Wake me when the show starts."
When Statler points out that it's been going on for a while,
he says, "Oh, well then wake me when it's over."
We go backstage 3, where the pigs are once again still wandering around backstage making a lot of noise. We have a very, as you say, visually, we have a new camera setup here in order to incorporate the pigs in sort of the middle ground, the balcony leading to the dressing rooms where we have 3 other characters. We have Hilda and Zoot and Wayne.
Correct.
And then in the very foreground on the left-hand side of the screen, we have Kermit surveying all of this. And talking to all of this.
Yes, and the pigs are being loud, so he tells everyone to knock it off. And so then we get a chorus of Hilda saying, "Knock it off," then Zoot saying, "Knock it off," and then Wayne looking down over the balcony at the pigs directly, telling him to knock it off.
At which point Kermit says, "Will you knock off all the knocking it off?"
And it goes in reverse. This time Wayne starts it, tells Zoot to knock off the knocking it offs. And then Zoot relays that information to Hilda, and
then starts to tell the pigs to knock off the knocking it off.
And then Kermit freaks out, and then walks
over to his desk.
Yep, and Piggy's standing there, and she once again starts laying it on thick.
I'll just point out that as he's walking over there, he's muttering, "If I never have to see another pig again, it'll be too soon."
And then
what is waiting for him? But the amorous advances.
And she's talking about how she loves when he gets angry, and he starts scrunching up.
"In you, I see a seething volcano ready to erupt like Vesuvius."
And that blows his top, and he erupts at her.
At which point, she says, "He loves me."
Yeah.
Which is, again, a weird response, but then he says, "I give up." At which point, she says, "I knew you would," and launches on him. Violent romantic assault in the workplace.
No Disney Plus warning on this episode. Kermit escapes and then goes to introduce Fozzie.
We don't see the escape. We just cut to him coming out on stage to introduce Fozzie. And it's a bit of a tone switch. Like, he goes from being exasperated to being professional with almost supernatural ability.
Those lights will... Once you hit the stage lights...
You're a whole different person.
Yeah, just it's a switch.
And as you mentioned, Fozzie is trying something new because he has bought a new act.
Yes, he bought a bunch of impressions.
But yes, he's doing impressions of celebrities, and Statler and Waldorf seem to think that this might be great.
Yeah, although they that he does say, I've got something new in my act, and they say, comedy, maybe?
Good burn.
Yep, I did enjoy that. Yeah, so he does...
great actors from great movies. And in each case, he turns around, gets himself in character by rubbing the top of his head and being about to put his hat on, at which point he swivels back around and does the impression without his hat on. Not quite putting the hat on is part of the process.
So as someone who has probably never seen these episodes before, mm-hmm. and also probably never seen the source material that these impressions are from...
I assumed you knew one out of the three. Yeah,
of course. And I've heard of all three people. Okay. But I've never seen any of these three things, to my knowledge. I was wondering if these were all performances where there's hat business, where they do that motion with their hat before saying whatever line they say.
No. The three impressions, therefore, are Humphrey Bogart.
Specifically in Casablanca.
Where he says, play it again, Sam. The second is from the film Mr. Roberts, and the star is...
Jimmy Cagney. Never heard of Mr. Roberts before.
Mr. Roberts is I think it's an early Jimmy Stewart, and Jimmy Cagney is the heavy. It's a military character drama. He's the high-ranking officer, and there is a long-running bit with a rubber palm tree that he keeps outside of his quarters and waters and needs his men to take care of. And the thematic resonance being that he cares more about the palm tree than he cares about his men.
So he says, who took my palm tree?
Yeah.
Okay, I get it now.
And then he says, and lastly, Cary Grant in all of his movies. At which point he turns around and says, Judy, Judy, Judy.
Yep, didn't get this one either.
Well, you're lucky you're talking to a guy who has a little bit of a fixation on a movie with Cary Grant in it.
Yeah, if it wasn't from that or another one.
Very specific.
Yeah, then there's no way I would have known what it was.
Cary Grant legendarily has never said the phrase, Judy, Judy, Judy.
Okay.
However, it is a line that is attributed to him. The consensus seems to have been, Cary Grant was interviewed a lot about this over his lifetime, and when he was doing a touring live Q&A show called An Evening with Cary Grant shortly before he died, he, in interviews there, said that he believed that it was somebody who was doing an impression of him that came up with it. I think there's a lot of truth to that because the phrase is not Judy, Judy, Judy. It's Judy, Judy, Judy. And it feels to me like the sort of thing you do in order to get in impression mode.
It's your touchstone?
Yeah, it's your opening thing to find his voice. And
it's your Ronald Reagan whale?
Exactly. In 1964, on the Andy Griffith Show, there's an episode where Jim Nabors and Goober do this exact bit, where Andy Griffith is being told, after having been introduced to Goober for the first time, you should hear his Cary Grant impression, at which point Goober goes, Judy, 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 Judy. And I thought that that was an odd coincidence. It appears to not have been an episode of the Andy Griffith Show that the Muppet writers worked on.
Well, and this can't have been the case because this isn't how television works, but with Jim Nabors coincidentally being the episode before this in production order, then maybe it was something that he said offhandedly, or maybe in their research for writing that episode, they came across it, and instead of doing it in that episode, they did it in this one.
It seems unlikely that they would have come across in 1976 an episode from 1964 in a rerunless planet.
Yeah, the internet didn't exist. They couldn't just YouTube funny right. Jim Nabors bits.
That's right. I did think it was interesting that that episode took place about a year after the movie Charade came out, which...
Nice.
One of the things that happened in that is that there is a outtake. There is a behind-the-scenes film bit where the writer was on set asking Grant about the Judy, Judy, Judy thing, at which point Grant looked to camera and said it, and said, there, finally now it's on film. I've actually said it.
That's fun.
We spent way too much time on this, but only because it happens to be in a niche area I enjoy. But that gives you an idea. In 1963 and 1964, this had already been hounding Grant for years. It's a good established punchline of that's the worst Cary Grant impression you can do, because it's something he didn't actually say, it's cliche, and he does it badly.
Well, now I have the context to make this whole bit funnier to me, so yeah. Thank you. But Statler and Waldorf say,
all your impressions sound the same.
Yeah.
I can't help that. They were all written by the same writer.
Such a good joke.
Yeah.
And hilariously, Statler and Waldorf seem to have to accept it as rational. They have no defense against that.
Yeah, it's definitely not the performer's fault for not performing the impressions. It's in the writer's voice. He's doing it in the writer's voice.
I was very impressed with that joke, and it's a good...
I'm glad you were impressed with Vadi's impression.
Oi! What then ends the joke is they call out and ask, how about you do an impression of a bear leaving the stage? At which point Fozzie dips below camera.
And does an impression of a bear stage, a B-A-R-E stage.
And then comes up and says, I love me, I'm too good for this show.
So this being production episode 7 mm-hmm. does make sense for this part of it to have been pushed later, because this is him coming into his own. If this was happening earlier in the season and then we see him not succeeding, which I'm sure we'll see him not succeeding
again
as the episodes go on, but it makes more sense for this to be later for the overall character arc of Fozzie.
And interesting that it is once again going to the well of, as you say, him buying jokes, and that's the way in which he's failing. It's not his personality. It's that the material isn't right for him.
Mm-hmm. And it ends with Statler and Waldorf saying, either he's getting better or we're getting worse.
The next sketch is a Florence Henderson musical number, after which we go backstage where we have Kermit going through the running order of the show and says, oh, I guess we didn't have time for Gonzo on the show this week. That's too bad.
Yeah. If only Gonzo was around to hear Kermit lamenting the fact that he didn't have time to be on the show, it would probably make him feel better.
It's a nice bit. However, this is where Piggy swooshes back on in order to say, this is all about Florence Henderson. Do we want to therefore bump this as a potentially as a part of a Florence bit?
Sure.
Okay.
So then, in that case, the last sketch we have to talk about is Planet Coosbane.
Mm-hmm. The first mention of Planet Coosbane in the real show.
Also the first time Kermit's in the trench coat reporting from a place.
Mm-hmm. This is, of course, something he's been doing on Sesame Street for the last 5 years, where he has been the Sesame Street news reporter and has been narrating various scenes from fairy tales, folklore, and nursery rhymes.
Yeah, but narrating an alien mating ritual, not necessarily appropriate for Sesame Street.
This sketch, in its entirety, was filmed as part of the Muppet Valentine show.
Really?
Yeah, because the Muppet Valentine show was lots of different sketches about love.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Kermit doing Planet Earth. Kermit doing mating rituals between strange species. These are basically alien bower birds. What are birds of paradise? That's what they're called. Where they have the very, very strange ways of arranging their feathers and building nests in order to attract a mate.
Sure.
You really don't know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, Peter, how did you not stumble across the best episode of Planet Earth, where they just had amazing photographs of birds that just looked like birds until they would puff out their feathers and do weird little dances, and you're like, that's not a bird, what the hell is that? They were amazing.
Audience, I'm shrugging visually.
I'm just shocked that you missed the whole Planet Earth experience. For a while,
oh,
Planet
I own it on
Earth
DVD.
Was the most sold Blu-ray on the planet.
Yeah, I have it. I own it. Never seen it.
Anyway, that's what this is a structural parody of, obviously, even if you haven't seen that.
Also,
you know that.
That came out in the 2000s, and this came out in 1976.
But that kind of Richard
National Geographic.
I was going to say Attenborough BBC nature special is legendary and multi-generational.
Yeah. I understood the source material.
I'm just being clear that you did. My point is that Coosbane is talked about as if it's a thing that is established in Muppet lore already. Thrown out there at the beginning of the sketch, like, that's a word you know.
Yeah. You got to establish where they are, that they're not on the moon or wherever.
We have Frank Oz doing yeoman work as the male Kuzbanian.
We're waiting now for the male Kuzbanian creature to make the first move. Hark, that may be him now.
Yeah, so I have a complaint about this sketch. I loved this sketch.
Okay.
But I have one complaint, which is this sketch starts when the male Kuzbanian introduces himself before he comes on screen. He hi-yas.
Yeah.
And with this episode being so heavy with Miss Piggy hitting people and saying hi-yas, I honestly thought that she was interrupting the sketch. And then when the male Kuzbanian came out, I was like, no, it's not that at all. But it threw me for a loop. So despite enjoying it, it pulled me out of it initially, and then I had to get back into it.
This is the precise reason why we have people on the show that haven't seen these things before. That is astonishing. I never would have made that connection. Nope, it is Frank Oz. He is saying hi-ya.
Yeah. He's, you know, saying, who else says hi-ya? Piggy.
But
in this episode,
he's been saying hi-ya as the male Kuzbanian for years.
Oh, okay.
Prior to Miss Piggy ever doing karate.
Fair.
That is a new wrinkle with Piggy, whereas this is prior form for Oz as this particular alien puppet. Frank does some real big yodeling weirdness in this. Nelson does some real screechy laughs, and they're great. And then the physical performance of the male Kuzbanian, who keeps on looking to camera with joy and astonishment at the fact that he is being selected for his weird mating behavior, is, again, beautiful.
Natural mating behavior, but it's not weird at all. This is how the Kuzbanians mate, we're told.
How dare you be right. I think it's important that we get to the end of the sketch, because A, it's hard to describe, and B, we've been talking for a while, and C, because it adds to our statistics.
It does. So, yeah, that's another interesting visual thing that they do in this episode. So the Kuzbanians do a little mating call and response thing, and then they, like a duel, turn back to back, walk 10 paces from each other, turn around, and then start sprinting towards each other, and it cuts between them, and it goes on for far too long.
And then they smash into each other and literally explode.
Yep.
And the explosion produces a litter of baby Kuzbanians.
They are the same red color as Elmo, and they have similar big eyes, but their bodies are different. But they were Elmo-esque.
They were Elmo-esque. I thought they were Cookie Monster-esque, except for the color.
So that is technically an explosion, and also, even though there's a little bit afterwards,
there is a line afterwards where Kermit says,
"Once again, love comes to Kuzbane."
Yeah, so I did count it as an end explosion.
Good, I concur.
Then we get an audience shot, and then we have the outro with Florence. Ben, how dare you? Put some respect on her name.
And then after the credits, we have Statler and Waldorf, with Statler saying that he loved it.
And Waldorf says, "So what? You also loved World War II.
Does this imply that Statler is a war criminal?
I don't know. He may just be like most old people who just love war.
I like that better. I hope he's just one of those closet fascists who continually has the History Channel on.
Mm-hmm. Also, because it's not really related to Florence, the credits are different this episode. I don't know if you noticed
the spacing.
Yep, and the font, and also they credit, I should have written it down, the Muppeteers are credited as, Frank and Jim are credited first as Muppet performances by, or something like that, and then other performers below. But yeah, it was really weird. I did learn that this is the British credit sequence. So this is what the Brits would have seen every week. So maybe it's not on the DVD, but on Disney Plus, it's the only episode to use the British credit sequence.
No, it definitely looked visually different to me. My operating guess was because after Florence is thanked and they go into the theme music, the Tower of Bouncing Borsellinos comes out, wanders on stage, and then falls. And I suspected that you didn't want the credits big and in the center because it ruined the visual joke. that you couldn't really see them do it. And so to have the credits over to the left-hand side of the screen provided a visual pillar for that joke to take place in.
Understood. That makes sense.
That's obviously wrong now that you've told me that, but it did...
It may be the reason why they did it.
Why they kept it.
Yeah.
That's possible.
So that's the end of the episode for non-Florence Henderson things. So Ben, why don't you ask me what I know about Florence Henderson and I will... attempt to answer the questions?
As always, there are one or two things about Florence Henderson that you do know that you've forgotten.
Oh, yeah.
But let's get through some of the stuff that you don't know first. Florence Henderson was born in 1934 and was in her first starring touring show by the time she was 18 and was in a lead and an on-Broadway original by 20. During this period, she documents in her 2011 biography, quite casually, six different attempts by family, clergy, producers, and men in general to sexually assault her, all while she was underage. Disappointingly, despite all this, who has a cover blurb on the back of her book? A. Bill Cosby. B. Charlie Rose. C. Harvey Weinstein.
I'm gonna go with Charlie Rose.
Bill Cosby.
That was my first guess, but I figured the CBS connection.
She worked with him during a stage residency, and she quotes him a couple of times in the book. Question number two. Florence states that she loved doing television appearances, particularly game shows and talk shows, where she relished the opportunity to hold her own against the outsized personalities of the hosts. Which of these three anecdotes from the biography is untrue? A. After a number of successful appearances on Jack Parr, Henderson was hired as the fashion host of the fledgling Today Show. When she became pregnant with her second child, a fact they tried to cover up because she couldn't even say pregnant on the air in 1960, she was replaced with Barbara Walters. B. Henderson was the first woman to guest host The Tonight Show, a duty that she returned to at least three more times prior to Kermit hosting in 1979. Or C. For the Mike Douglas Show in 1966, she was contracted as part of a rotating month-long musical support role. This had previously been filled by Rat Pack hangers-on, which is when she discovered that Douglas had a fragile ego about women performers and would frequently make snide remarks if she had received too much attention or applause from the studio audience.
That sounds totally true. So I'm going to discard that immediately. I'm going to go with B, because my guess is she did host it, but she wasn't first.
Nope. She says in the book that's probably going to be the two things that are about her in her obituary, is that she was the first female guest host and that she was on the Brady Bunch. I don't know anything about Mike Douglas, so I apologize for dragging his name through the mud. That anecdote is from her experiences working with Milton Berle on the road in Las Vegas.
All right, so I wasn't wrong to know that the story was true, just the name is different.
Yep. Question number three. Florence Henderson's film debut, apart from an uncredited cameo in the 1969 film Some Kind of Nut with Dick Van Dyke, was as the romantic lead in Song of Norway, a musical biography about the pianist and composer Edvard Grieg. Which of the following is not true? A. While the film was marketed as The Next Sound of Music, it was based on a 1944 operetta that Universal Pictures bought the rights to in 1946 and had previously tried to film in 1954, a full 5 years before Sound of Music appeared on Broadway. B. The film was so critically panned that New York Times critic Vincent Canby felt the need to justify its lack of inclusion in his annual Worst 10 Movies list in 1970. Or C. Despite the drubbing for the acting in the script, the film nevertheless was nominated for 4 Oscars and won 1. Specifically, it beat out the theme for Love Story and got Best Original Score. This caused such an outcry that they created Rule 16 of the Academy's Special Rules for Music Awards, where pre-existing compositions, in this case, the works of Edvard Grieg, couldn't count towards a award nomination.
Okay. Again, you know, by the fact that C happened, and considering we talked about Love Story not too long ago,
So I'm gonna go with A. No, I tricked you by doing the love story thing. All of those Oscar nominations were for Scrooge, not at all for Song of Norbert.
Fair.
Question number 4. Henderson grew to parody her clean-cut Carol Brady image later in her career and found willing collaborators in the spoof industry. You have therefore seen her in Naked Gun 33 and a Third as up for winning an Oscar. Of these three, two are also places where Florence skewered her clean-cut premise. One is not.
Okay.
In chronological order, A, Florence plays a white lady who speaks jive to the two black men in Airplane in 1980. B, Florence is the special guest in an episode of Police Squad in 1982 and then is killed in the opening credits. C, Florence is the Michelle Pfeiffer stand-in in Amish Paradise by Weird Al Yankovic.
I'm going to go with the Weird Al Amish Paradise is the untrue thing.
No. No. It is Barbara Billingsley who plays the white lady who speaks.
Okay, so I was right that I was wrong on that.
Mm-hmm. Who basically is playing against her role as the mother in Leave It to Beaver.
But we have one question left, and I know what that question is going to be, so I'm going to mark down that I got zero things right.
And for our last question, I'm going to put 60 seconds on the clock for 6 degrees in 60 seconds. When I read out Florence Henderson's top 4 most known for on IMDb, any of those that are films, Pete can use to try and connect Florence Henderson to Jim Henson.
I can't wait for there to be someone who only has TV things and I'm not allowed to use any of them.
Her top 4 includes The Brady Bunch, The Brady Bunch Variety Hour.
Okay, so we're down to 2.
The Brady Bunch movie.
Okay, I got one.
Where she plays Grandma Brady opposite Shelley Long, Gary Cole, and Michael McKean. And lastly, Shakes the Clown with Robin Williams and Bobcat Goldthwait. However, when I first did the research for this many months ago, Naked Gun 33 and a Third, The Final Insult, was in her top 4. So I'm going to give you that as well, even though it's not currently there. So you've got Leslie Nielsen, O.J. Simpson, George Kennedy, Michael McKean, Shelley Long, Gary Cole, Robin Williams, Bobcat Goldthwait, and anybody else in those movies that you can think of. Having used those lists, I've been able to find 2 3 Degrees connections. Can you do the same?
No.
In under 60 seconds?
Of course not.
Well, let's give it the old minute try, starting now.
Okay, so here's my instinct, is to go through the Brady Bunch movie to Christine Taylor, who is Ben Stiller's wife, who has appeared with him in many, many things. Can I tell you any of them off the top of my head right now? No, but I know for a fact that they've appeared together in many movies.
Well, that may not be a good instinct then.
Don't care, because I'm going to go from Ben Stiller to a bunch of other people, and that's all I had in the preamble of the question of that's where I got to. So, let's see.
30 seconds left.
Yeah, the rest of this 30 seconds is going to be silence because I've hit a stumbling block. Because I figured that would be easier for me to do. And then, okay, Ben Stiller, the RDJ, can I get, RDJ to Jon Favreau, Jon Favreau to Guardians of the Galaxy at some point, I guess, probably. Oh no, RDJ did Guardians of the Galaxy to Kurt Russell, to Kurt Russell to whatever we said a couple episodes ago. I'm done, I did it, hooray.
Congratulations! Time is up!
Although that would be way more than 6 degrees, but I still did it.
I think that was either 6 or 7 degrees. What I did...
I'm counting that as a win. I'm counting that as half a point.
I think it counts. I mean, it would have been better if you could have actually named a movie that...
Anything?
Actually naming a Ben Stiller movie that he appeared in and his wife would have been a strong start.
Yeah.
As opposed to, they've been in lots of things together.
Dodgeball. Sure. I'm 100% positive that's accurate.
I went with Shelley Long is in Night Shift with Michael Keaton, who's in Batman Returns with Michelle Pfeiffer, to the Jim Henson in Into the Night, was the way in which I got there. However, there's a better one than that. Michael McKean is in Clue with Madeline Kahn, who's in the Muppet movie with Jim Henson. So that was the shortest one I was able to find.
Also, I just looked it up, and yes, Christine Taylor was in both Dodgeball and Zoolander. So my poll of she must have been in Dodgeball is correct.
If not during the actual 60 seconds.
Awesome.
So you got 1 point out of 5.
Yes.
With that out of the way, let's talk about Florence Henderson's contributions and collaborations in this episode. Her first appearance is in a musical number where she performs Bob Lynn's Elusive Butterfly in what is essentially a straight-up rock video.
Yeah, there is a butterfly.
Yellow butterfly in the middle of a white birch forest with white leaves.
And that's the only Muppet, quote-unquote, in this entire segment.
Correct. At one point, at the very end, Florence turns into a cloud of butterflies, and those are also puppet-winged, dangling on wires. But there are no named or familiar-looking traditional Muppets in this scene.
Yeah. If I hadn't had my revelation a couple episodes about this being a variety show and not a sketch show, I would have hated this. But again, had no idea she could sing. Mm. She can sing.
Yeah.
And also going back to what I said at the beginning of this episode, it's an incredibly visually interesting performance. It's not just her standing there singing to camera. She's walking, the camera's cutting, it's doing wipes, it's doing dissolves.
Mm-hmm. It's creating a very effective atmosphere of magic realism. The fact that she does turn into a cloud of butterflies at the end works because she has dissolved in and out of the white misty forest in a supernatural way.
And she's wearing a very flowy, colorful, frocky dress thing.
That has a pattern that looks, I don't believe actually is, but is mimicking the kind of patterns you would have on a butterfly wing.
Yeah, and it's so flowy that when she outstretches her arms, it basically creates wings as well. So there's allusions to her being a butterfly through the entire thing. Again, if I hadn't had that revelation, I would have hated this. I really liked this.
I'm always reminded in sketches like this how much Jim Henson is a technical filmmaker and a person who wants to push the boundaries of technology. Mm-hmm. That he's often using wipes and overlays, and that puppets are just a way of having easily accessible special effects. But that he was a pioneer in digital filmmaking in lots of different techniques, and that through inclination or practice, he is a very detailed technical filmmaker. And this music video is a miniature version of that, the way in which they create the forest and then use layering and trick shots in order to have her fade in and out of it and to create very striking visuals.
Yeah, and make it seem like even though they're on a studio set, that she's in a forest. Yeah, it's bigger than just the probably 12 square feet that it is.
I find this song to be dopey. Mm-hmm. However, weirdly enough, when it was released in 1966, it reached number 5 in both the UK and US spots, sung by 2 different artists. Hmm. It was sung by the composer Bob Lind in the US, whereas Val Dunikin performed it simultaneously and reached the same chart number in the UK. This song on Wikipedia has a fascinating look into the way in which the notion of cover versions has changed so much. And we've alluded a little bit to this in the past, to the fact that songs aren't owned the same way back then. Petula Clark also sung this in 66. Sonny and Cher also recorded this in 1966. Billy Walker also, and Richard Anthony in French also recorded this in 1966. Before 1980, Johnny Mathis, the Lennon Sisters, Glenn Campbell, Aretha Franklin, the Four Tops, all recorded it, and then Dolly Parton recorded it in 1984. People embraced the hell out of this song.
That clarifies it for me in terms of why they didn't Muppet it up then. Mm. If it was that popular and that much of a known quantity, that they wouldn't have then made it silly. They stayed true to the various
dramatic aspects.
Yeah. Interesting.
The next time Florence shows up on stage or on screen is during the talk spot. I meant to look up what the hell limpid meant. I'm not sure, but I think that the line, eyes like limpid pools, might be a Shakespearean reference. If not, it has that romantic poetry quality to it.
So I just Googled limpid pools, and People also ask section says, who said your eyes are like limpid pools? The answer, according to Shakespeare notes, is Pepe Le Pew. Adjective of a liquid free of anything that darkens completely clear, of a person's eyes unclouded or clear.
Okay, so Kermit is saying, gosh, Flo, you don't got no cataracts.
Mm-hmm.
All right, clear eyes.
Full heart. Can't lose.
I refuse. Still scans, still rhymes. But this is all leading up to massive amounts of jealousy for Piggy, whereas Kermit is very definitely hitting on Florence Henderson.
Your eyes are like two limpid pools.
Oh, that's very sweet, Kermit.
And when I look into your eyes, I'm spellbound.
And then Piggy enters and he says, I see trouble, instead of finishing the third compliment.
But Florence nimbly says, you've got it all wrong. Kermit is practicing on me for you, which is a lie that she had not cleared with Kermit, because Kermit does not like where this story is going.
Yeah.
Here's a joke I assumed that you didn't get, because I didn't get it. Piggy comes round the back behind Florence, grabs Kermit, and says,
oh, I am like putty in your hands. Putty, putty.
The trivia track helpfully pointed me towards the fact that there is a song by 1930s African-American comedic singer-songwriter Slim Gaylard called Cement Mixer Putty Putty. Gaylard is part of a comic duo, Slim and Slam. Most famous number is Flatfoot Floogy with a Floy Floy.
I'm supposed to know that?
You do know that. Anyway, if I were to guess, Florence or one of the writers just was responding to the putty putty bit and threw it in rehearsal, and they kept it.
Yeah.
Because it has there's no follow-up to it,
mm-hmm.
which makes it stand out a little bit before it's quickly discarded and moved on.
Yeah. But then Florence and Piggy have a discussion.
Mm-hmm. Where Florence says, we're old friends. It's just platonic.
Is she gone?
Yes. She's off to find her love.
And then she karate chops her
mm-hmm.
and bites her on the arm.
Mm-hmm.
Another bite. That's pretty much it for the talk spot.
Yeah, it ends in violence mm-hmm. and a fade to black, as most things do that are violent.
Then we have the panel discussion.
Mm-hmm. The question of lasting importance is, was William Shakespeare in fact Bacon, is what Kermit puts to Zoot, Piggy, Florence, and the Guru. This is a question as to whether or not Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare. And one of the prominent possibilities in the non-Stratfordian view is that Francis Bacon wrote Shakespeare, which Kermit is able to eventually sneak in there if you're paying attention. But mostly, this is just a litany of, as Piggy puts it, constant pig slurs.
But also, when he tries to clarify, no, Francis Bacon,
mm-hmm.
Piggy misunderstands as Francis Bacon.
Oh, no, 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 no. See, I meant Francis Bacon.
Francis Bacon, at least bacon chicken, little fucking bacon. Who cares? It's all in bad taste.
It's a good joke in there, too. Basically, the game of this sketch is everyone makes a, as Piggy refers to it, as a pig slur,
mm-hmm.
and then she beats them up.
We have two more karate chops in this section.
So, yes, she hits Floyd 9 times.
Mm.
He gets the brunt of it. Then Florence makes a joke and laughs at her own joke,
mm-hmm.
to which the Guru says,
we have a saying in my country, a woman who laughs at her own joke seldom has branches on her shoe trees.
That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
So, don't visit our country.
Which I think is a fair response.
Yeah.
If I were a guru, that would also be my equanimical response to criticism. At which point, the Bouncing Borsellino brothers show up to say that they've been listening backstage and they've had just enough about all this garbage about Bacon.
Yep. Also because Piggy asked for all the pigs of the world to unite.
Mm.
So that probably was
the call to action.
Yes.
At which point they try to build their pyramid and fall down around Florence. At which point she says,
oh no, I didn't write this down.
Cute act.
All right. Yeah, I missed it. Logging it. Thank you, Ben.
And with chaos generally tumbling all over the place, Kermit decides to pull a line under all this and say that next week's panel discussion is going to be,
do attack dogs make good house pets? To which our favorite fake dog comes out and bites Kermit.
No, doesn't work. it's not connected enough to what's going on. Yeah. If Piggy had been holding the dog in her lap more, if it had been there on stage with her in some way, there'd been a reference to, and even Fluffy doesn't want to hear these pig slurs, anything to have had him not just come out of nowhere to bite Kermit, then it might have worked.
Yeah.
But yep. All the others have come organically out of the falling apart of the panel discussion, and this one did not.
Yeah. But Piggy goes to the aid of her man, and she hits the dog 3 times.
So as far as you're concerned, it's a success because it increases your violence quota.
It is both a bite. It is our third bite of the episode, and 3 more hits get logged.
Worth it.
Yep. The next time we see Florence is when she sings Happy Together with a chorus of Frapples and other Muppets.
This reached all the way to number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1967. It's generally considered to be one of the first best one-hit wonders. This adaptation of it, of the Frackle Monster crowd doing the choral background to the melody, is a really good arrangement.
Yeah, amazing.
And it's a one-shot. There's no cutting, which leads to my repeated theory that this was sung live. And there's one of the things that helps reinforce the fact that it's a live performance is that as she's singing, she starts laughing and then turns it into just a real, you know, dialogue and laughter in the from a note to into that, which would have been not impossible, but might as well be impossible to try and lip sync along to.
We're happy together.
Similar to in La La Land when they laugh during City of Stars. That's 2.
Are you happy that I got my Sherrod reference and you got your La La Land episode in?
Uh-huh.
All right, good. Each of us checkmarking our obsessions.
Yeah, I didn't take a lot of notes on this because I simply said really great performance. Like, it's just wonderful. Then we have Backstage 4, which we touched on a little bit.
Now, the reason we glanced off this earlier is the conversation is specifically about Henderson.
Well, Romeo, how are you and Miss Henderson getting along?
Piggy, jealousy doesn't become you.
Because they are now reacting to the talk spot.
And then in the panel discussion saying pig slurs, so now Piggy definitely doesn't like her.
But it's also, therefore, a continuation of the fact that Shakespeare was brought up in the panel discussion because Piggy starts quoting Shakespeare in this, where she says,
"Methinks that doth protest too much."
And then Kermit brings it right back to, "Is that Shakespeare? Because it sounds more like Bacon."
And then she freaks out, hits him 5 times.
It's hi-ya number 6, but it's 5 more hits.
Yeah, it's a hi-ya and then a series of stomps.
And ends with her saying, "You always hurt the one you love."
Then we have a quick blackout sketch featuring our pal Sweetums with our pal Flo.
And Sweetums stops her to say, "Hey, by the way, I could really fall for you."
Florence says, "Are you serious?" And then he falls over and she looks down the barrel of the camera and says, "He's serious."
Her final appearance, therefore, is as everybody comes back for the goodbyes in front of the curtain. And as Kermit says, you know, "That's all the time we have for the show." Florence says how glad she was to have been there and that she especially enjoyed her love scenes with Kermit. Which is odd because it seems like deliberate taunting of Piggy.
And then she doesn't show up.
Correct. The end joke is a Fozzie bit.
Yeah, you hear him yelling from offstage, wire for Miss Henderson. And he repeats it a few times and then presents her with a coat hanger, which she then looks dismayed at and then hangs it off of his nose and then smiles.
The hanging on his nose is, again, if this were a real person, would be aggressive. But the fact that it so perfectly wraps around Fozzie's bulbous nose is kind of endearing.
And then we get the British credits and the episode is over. So, Ben, earlier you asked about the music in this episode.
Yes.
And you suspected that this would be the least amount of music.
Because we've got the UK spot and we've got 2 Florence performances. But in my mind, there's usually at least one more performance than that.
So you are correct, kind of.
Okay.
It is the least number of musical numbers, but in terms of length, it is longer.
Huh?
Barely. The Peter Ustinov episode was our most recent.
That was the one with the least amount of music so far.
Yeah, and this episode has a whopping 22 seconds more music. So this episode is 32.49% music, where the Peter Ustinov episode was 30.98% music. Okay. We had a total of 23 hits, 3 bites, 1 explosion, 1 end explosion, the same explosion, and 1 human Muppet kiss. So we are at 119 hits total for the season. 6 kisses, 9 explosions, 4 end explosions, 6 cute blanks, and 3 bites.
But Pete, were they at least quick bites?
No.
So I won't be able to watch them on Roku later?
No, they were longer than 10 minutes each.
And how does Florence Henderson fall in your ranking of guests?
So, I think my revelation was key, and we'll see how this affects
earlier
stats
guests.
Yeah, later. But I put her at number 5. I thought she was great.
Now, we have 1 and 3. Do we have 6 and 4?
We do not.
Okay.
We have 1, 3, 5, 7, 10, 17.
Who's 7?
14, 20, and 23. 7 is Paul Williams.
Okay. So currently in your brain, this was slightly better than Paul Williams in terms of a guest and slightly less than Rita Moreno. But still, everybody pales in comparison to Ruth Buzzi.
Accurate.
Any other stats that you can think of or things that we need to cover in terms of numerical breakdown?
The only number thing left to talk about is our top 5 moments. How's that for a segue?
I love it. As always, we will therefore end with our top 5 moments. Moments are not a full sketch, but are a piece of performance, dialogue, or a grace note that we want to make sure that we emphasize so that it doesn't go unnoticed and unheralded. So why don't you lead us in our moment countdown this week?
All right. I'm going to start with In Happy Together.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the end, when the Frackles are doing the chorus of the ba-ba-ba-buzz, and Flo looks into one of their mouths, and ba-ba-buzz into their mouth. And I loved it.
That's interesting. I did not particularly pick up on that.
It's like she was looking into the abyss and singing into it.
Excellent. I'm going to, for my number 2, point out a thing that Florence does in her performance during the talk spot, which is that she responds to Piggy like Piggy is real in a particular way, which is that whenever Piggy pushes past Florence to get to Kermit or flounces away from Kermit and bumps into Florence, Florence reacts like Piggy is a fully fleshed, stocky human being and gets bumped. Like, she reacts like, I felt that. Which is the proper response to somebody who can karate chop you. Piggy clearly has a real physicality. However, the Muppet puppet probably does not.
Mm-hmm.
And for Florence to put in the extra work to react as if Piggy is not foam, but pig.
Yeah. I mean, Tiny weighs 975 pounds.
I thought that was great. It was a piece of her adding to the reality. It reminded me of what she talked about in terms of the reason she enjoyed being on game shows and talk shows was the ability to react live to things. That kind of living in the moment, responding to the characters as if they're real, shows what kind of an actress she is, that she wants to add to the situation and make it as fully fleshed, no pun intended, as possible.
For my second moment, our third moment, I wanted to re-bring up George.
Ah!
It made me laugh so hard every time he headbutted Mildred.
Speaking of Frank Oz's puppet physicality.
Yeah, and I realized on the second watch that the physicality of it was good, but it was the sound of Mildred's glasses clanking off of her eyeballs. You can really hear it.
1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3.
They're just a couple of floor hogs.
And it brought me so much joy.
For the fourth of the five moments, I'm going to drag us back to Coosbane. Watching it in both versions was interesting in that it helped reinforce the parts that they clearly loved because they did it exactly the same way. One of the timing and delivery punchlines in that never fails to crack me up is once the female Muppet has announced herself with the traditional response to the wonk wonk, and Kermit turns to camera and says with complete sincerity in his voice,
"Ah, there she is, and what a beauty."
As if he's a host of a beauty pageant.
He's projecting himself out there to try and get the audience to say, that is somebody on Coosbane that somebody would be glad to mate with, and it's hilarious.
Yep. For the final moment, I would like to talk about the thing that I think we both didn't talk about
earlier,
yes, which is, let's see if we were on the same page on this, Piggy snorting in between kissings.
You did mention this, that we needed to come back to it, and I'm so glad you did. It is the thing, it is the unspoken weirdness of this episode, that when Piggy first accosts Kermit and kisses him, she takes a break and then snorts like a pig while smooching him.
Yeah, when she's coming up for air for a breath, she snorts and then goes back in for the kissing.
Oh, my love, my life!
For all the emphasis of this episode about pig slurs and pig identity, we still very rarely encounter Miss Piggy acting like a pig. And so for Oz to have decided that she would revert to her true animal nature in the heights of passion and breathlessness is a real choice.
Mm-hmm. And it's a good choice. It's funny.
But it's also funny because it's shocking, mm-hmm, in that we, even after 45 years of Muppet Show, don't think of Piggy doing that. It was surprising. And so for it to have been there in this moment and apparently abandoned, it was funny regardless, but it's extra funny to know that somebody decided, we're swerving away from this choice.
I mean, I feel like she should go back to it. She should embrace her inner pig. It seems like she sometimes tries to be above it, and she should accept herself for who she is.
And we're all here for you, Piggy. If you decide that that's who you want to be, that you want to be true to your pig nature in that regard, in public, not just wherever you feel safe,
we support you. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is from archival Henson Associates clips of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they broadcast as Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @farstnamebasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
There are things, dates, facts, names, celebrity impressions, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect or confusing, please contact us via the website and we will post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Hi-ya!
And we'll see you next time when we discuss production episode 20, guest starring Valerie Harper.
Yay!